Greater LA, KCRW's show that connects you to the people and the places of Southern California. Hi, I'm Steve Chiatakis.
Shame on you! Shame on you! Shame on you!
That was a scene yesterday at LA City Council, where they voted to renew a controversial set of rules that restrict where people living in their cars or other vehicles can actually park. And that's where you are right now. At City Hall's Council Chambers, a cavernous, church-like room with wooden pews packed with people immediately after the vote. And as you can hear, the community activists and the residents who showed up to this meeting are angry. They say those rules criminalize homelessness. They're standing up, they're chanting, in some cases they're even yelling at city council members to stop the meeting and reverse the vote. Police officers actually handcuff one activist and lead her away. Now, in the middle of the chaos, one council member, Marquise Harris Dawson, leaves his perch at the front of the room, walks into the crowd, and starts arguing with one of the protesters. He asks her, "You know what the number one issue is that I get calls about?" And then he answers his own question.
Homeless encampments and people sleeping in cars. But I'm telling you, just like you want a response to your call, so do the people who are calling about encampments and people parked in cars.
KCRW's Anna Scott was there in the middle of all that chaos.
I was right there.
Right in the middle of it, and she joins me right now. Hi, Anna.
Hi.
All right, let's take it back to the beginning and what led to that chaotic scene. Can you explain the rules at the center of all of this?
Yeah, so like you said, this is all about when and where people who live in vehicles, so cars, RVs, vans, are allowed to park inside city limits. The rules say if you're living in your car, you cannot park overnight in residential areas. So between 9 p.m., 6 a.m., you can't sleep in your car, and you can't park at any time within a block of a school, a park, a preschool, or a daycare. So that's about within 500 feet. Now, these aren't brand new rules, but they lapsed at the beginning of July. So yesterday, the vote was to reinstate the rules.
That's pretty limiting right there. What does living in your car actually mean, though? Does it mean you can't sleep in your car in those places during those times?
Right. That's a good question. So sleeping in your car, but also you can't park in these places if you're obviously using the vehicle as a dwelling. So that means having things like sleeping bags or cooking equipment in the car or obscured windows like you see with a lot of RVs, things like that.
What's the penalty if you break that law?
So the first time you get a citation for $25, it's an infraction. If you get a second citation, it's $50. And then any additional violations beyond that are $75.
And these are folks who don't have the money to pay penalties like that, right? Obviously, when you don't pay city fines, we know people can end up with additional fines that are latched on, other legal trouble beyond that. Mm-hmm. Besides residential zones, the rules seem to focus, Anna, on areas where there are kids, schools and parks. That seems to be what we're talking about here.
Yeah, and there are several reasons for that. One is that people who use those facilities, so like parents who are dropping off students, visiting playgrounds, they need parking. Also, there are sanitation issues that have come up in complaint letters that city council members have received. There are a lot of complaints about trash, about filth, particularly with RVs. This goes to one of the reasons that people were so angry yesterday. There is a suggestion of danger there, right? It's hard to hear about these rules and not think about the rules around sex offenders and where they can and can't live. One person I spoke to, Matteo Nagasi, who was there at the meeting yesterday, he lives downtown, but actually used to live in his car for 2.5 years. And he said the people who are most endangered by this situation are the people in the cars, that it's very hard to find safe places to park.
There were nights where I forgot to lock the door, and you're sleeping in the car, and all of a sudden the door opens, you know, and it's terrifying.
He was one of dozens of people who showed up at yesterday's meeting, as you could hear at the top, to testify against this. And the big argument was that this criminalizes homelessness. That, of course, if there's criminal behavior going on among people living in vehicles, There is an entity to deal with that, the LAPD, but rules like this criminalize simply being homeless and living in your car. So there were people from community activist groups like K-Town for All, from a group called Services Not Sweeps. There were people with nonprofits that work with the homeless. One of them was Mel Tilakaratne. He's with an organization that runs a couple of safe parking sites.
Most of the people living in their vehicles work. Those are the people who come on our lots. We have a family on one of our lots right now with five kids living in a Chevy Tahoe. This law, if passed, is going to directly contribute to these people being on the street. This is a stupid law.
There were also a lot of residents there who don't work with homelessness nonprofits. One of them was Erica Ferriston. She is president of the Pacific Palisades Democratic Club.
But I am here speaking today as an individual and as a mother. Several of the families at my children's elementary school are struggling with homelessness, and it's unconscionable that they would be criminalized.
You've got these arguments going on here, and people who don't have a place to live, at least they have a car. That is their shelter, right?
Right.
Was there anybody at the meeting that supports these rules against sleeping in your car?
Well, nobody at the meeting spoke in support of these rules. It was almost an hour of solid opposition. Now, that doesn't mean that nobody in the city does support these rules. One of the reasons that the city council is voting on this is because they have received letters, they've received emails from people who have complained about trash, the sanitation issues that I mentioned earlier, about streets being full of RVs. But no supporters showed up at the meeting. It was a lot of what you just heard. And that's why after all of this testimony, people were a little bit stunned when the council took a very quick vote with no discussion and voted 13-0 to reinstate these rules.
13 ayes.
Okay, this item passes. Let's move on to item 31. Okay, members of the audience, you're disrupting this meeting. Thank you. We're moving on to item 31. Item 31.
So this is when all the chanting broke out and that scene that we heard a couple minutes ago. And this brings us back to where we started. So one council member in the middle of all this chaos, Marquise Harris Dawson, he represents South LA. He came into the crowd and spoke to one of the protesters and he spoke to reporters. And so here's part of that conversation.
I have a park in my district that when you don't have this law in place, no one in the neighborhood can use the park because there are RVs lined up around the entire park. So it is a balancing act. And again, a terrible situation. When you have 30,000 people living on the street, there are no good choices. Every choice is a bad choice. And that's what we're faced with today.
Every choice is a bad choice. And that I think that exemplifies the frustration of everybody, right? Everybody's going to be ticked off at you for whatever you do. But isn't it a part of the city council's job to find good choices, better choices than what we're hearing about?
And that really gets to the heart of what this is all about. When these rules first came into effect a few years ago, they were meant to be temporary. They were supposed to be in place while the city worked on better solutions, specifically opening more safe parking sites. So these are designated lots where people who live in vehicles can go and stay overnight that have bathroom access. So they're not parking in neighborhoods. But right now, around the city, there are less than 200 safe parking spots for more than 5,000 vehicles that house more than 9,000 people.
I want you to say that one more time. 200 safe spots for 5,000 vehicles.
Yeah. Now, that is going to be expanded this fall by approximately another 100 spots, but it's still obviously very short of the need. Now, the vote yesterday was only to extend these rules for another 6 months. So this is going to come back again.
All right. KCRW's Anna Scott on the homeless beat. Anna, thanks.
Thank you.
Well, imagine being one of those folks experiencing homelessness and searching for a shelter. You may even have the means to Google one. And there you'd see maybe a 4-star review, free food, drinks for those in need, a KFC on the bottom floor, a big pool or a hot tub. If you're desperate for a place to stay, you may even believe it. You may find a way to get there. That's exactly what's been happening in Tarzana for the past several months. Homeless people have been showing up at a mansion that was falsely identified by Google Maps as a homeless shelter. But why? Well, the answer has to do with a wealthy YouTube streamer and his fans. Here to talk about this strange story is Ariella Plakta, who's a reporter over at the LA Daily News. Ariella, thanks for being here.
Hi, thanks for having me.
How did you come across this story?
It was really just quite random. I was Googling homeless shelters in the San Fernando Valley, just sort of looking to see what institutions come up. And I saw this Ice Poseidon homeless shelter, and I had no idea what it was, but called the phone number that was listed on the actual location and sort of went from there.
Ice Poseidon is the YouTube name of Paul Dannino. This is the guy who has this channel on YouTube. Who is this guy?
He became pretty quickly one of the country's leading in real life streamers. He started as how most streamers do, as a gaming sort of person, and just has developed a huge following over the years. And part of the style of entertainment that real life streaming is that viewers and fans, in addition to paying or tipping Dannino to do things while he's streaming, a lot of them will also pull practical jokes and pranks that range from, you know, ordering a bunch of pizzas and alcohol to his house for him. And when the food delivery person shows up, Dannino can say, you know, that wasn't me. I didn't order that food. And so the fans sort of get to watch that in real time as a form of entertainment. So the homeless shelter location was really one of these pranks. And you can see in the reviews all of his fans that are sort of playing along with this idea. And some people fell for it.
I want to play one of the videos right now where a woman, and we assume that she's homeless, shows up at the house. Let's give a listen to that.
It's not a real homeless shelter. I'm sorry.
Wow.
Sorry you had to walk so far.
Yeah, I've walked all the way from Stockton, Crenshaw. I've walked out.
She's been walking for hours. Sorry you have to walk so far. And it's actually, in this video, I might add, it's raining.
Yeah.
So that was taken, I guess, a few months back. And people were misled to believing that this was a shelter, and this woman had walked a long way to find it. How many people do you think showed up at this house looking for shelter?
It's hard to know exactly. He says it's, you know, around dozens. I spoke to his former manager, whose phone number was listed on the location, and he said that number was receiving between 10 and 20 calls a day from people looking for places to sleep, whether or not they, you know, showed up or not. And based on just talking to residents, like neighbors and community leaders, and the residents who live there now, at least a dozen people did arrive to this house thinking that they would receive a bed.
This underscores the vulnerability, I think, of the homeless population, because these are folks who are seeking shelter, and they're Googling for the nearest shelter or the nearest place they can bathe or things like that. And this comes up. I mean, I guess maybe I'm naive. Is that funny to some folks to like lead them astray or make them walk for a long period of time to get to this place that really isn't a shelter?
I can't pretend to be an expert in this world. Like, I really found out about it when reporting this story for the first time. And of course, you can't really get inside someone's head, but we do know that internet trolls and, you know, online pseudonyms do sometimes give people the feeling of freedom to do things that they wouldn't ordinarily do in real life, or maybe not really fully understanding the consequences of their actions. But yeah, I mean, even Paul Dannino, Ice Poseidon himself, said that he at first did find this funny and only now later on realized that it's dumb, in his words.
You mentioned that Dannino is now in Texas. He left that house in Tarzana. Who lives there now? And are people still showing up?
Yeah, it's a group of businessmen. I spoke to one woman who didn't want to be identified, but she, you know, goes there every day to work there at the house. And she said that, you know, as recently as earlier in the week, she went to the door and found a woman and a man who appeared to be homeless and said they were looking for a shelter. And she had no idea what they were talking about. It was really only then where they looked on Google Maps and saw that the home that they just started renting is listed as a homeless shelter online, and, you know, looking into who's this guy Ice Poseidon. But now that it's taken down, I think that's, they can breathe a sigh of relief.
I mean, the story brings up this larger question about the internet and fake content on the internet. We know it's out there. And taking advantage of vulnerable people. I mean, how does Google Maps address that?
Yeah, so Google Maps says that this is something that they constantly have to work on in terms of fraud and scammers putting up fake businesses, fake locations, fake organizations. Actually, the product director of Google Maps, Ethan Russell, put out a blog post recently in response to a big Wall Street Journal report on fake Google Maps businesses, saying that they take more than they took more than 3 million fake business profiles down from Google Maps last year. 250,000 of them or so reported by people on the ground who realize that it's fake. So it sounds like they rely on people to report these things, and that they say they have a new system, but they don't share details because they don't want to, you know, give hints to people who are trying to take advantage.
It's all sort of one twisted world, isn't it?
Yeah, you know, it seems like there is a lot of profit being made on Google Maps, on YouTube, and this online world of streaming and internet entertainment. It doesn't stay on the internet, you know, it has real world consequences. And I think this is just one example of that.
Certainly does. Ariella Plachta, who reports over at the LA Daily News. Ariella, thanks for your time. We appreciate it.
Thanks so much. Thanks for having me.
What a story. Well, just ahead, old Hollywood comes to life on the big screen. Quentin Tarantino's latest pays close attention to the design details. You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW, available on podcasts wherever you get them. Thanks for sticking around for Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. A lot of folks have been talking about this new Quentin Tarantino film, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, and it has elicited all kinds of reactions. The backdrop is 1969 Los Angeles, where everything is changing, and a TV star and his longtime stunt double are trying to find their way.
So, Rick, explain to the audience exactly what it is a stunt double does.
Actors are required to do a lot of dangerous stuff. Cliff here is meant to help carry the load.
Is that how you describe your job, Cliff?
What, carrying his load? Yeah, it's about right.
The film recreates a soon-to-be changing Hollywood when production was still, at the time, centered here for the most part. The waning days, if you will, of the golden era. Here to talk about how the film was able to take us back to L.A. 50 years ago is our very own Frances Anderton, who hosts Design and Architecture on KCRW. Hi, Frances.
Hello, Steve.
You saw this movie, and you've spoken with the designers who worked on this film. Describe the look and the feel of it.
Well, I have to say, you mentioned that the film has produced mixed reactions. I think where there's unity in reaction is around the brilliance of the production design, which was helmed by a woman named Barbara Ling. Yes, what's fascinating about the movie, given that we're in a changing LA right now, we're in LA, in an LA that is trying to bring in more mass transit, that is trying to densify, that is trying to unbuild the way we were living back in the late 60s, the car-dependent LA, the time when the city sprawled, it was very low rise. It had big signage, it popped with commercial advertising. The freeways were relatively empty. You could drive.
That never happened, Francis.
Relatively, I should say. But anyway, what this movie does is it takes you to a time where the city felt spacious. You would, as I say, glide onto an almost empty freeway. You would speed through curving streets in your glamorous Carmen gear up to your hillside home. You would find hand-painted movie backdrops. You would, as I say, you would find the place sort of buzzing with neon. You would find movies being filmed. There would be a lot of backdrops. The Manson family, which is, of course, the kind of, you know, terrifying undertow to the entire movie, lives in what is an old ranch, the Spahn Ranch, where westerns were made.
A lot of folks who wrote about LA back then talk about the dominance of all that signage that you talk about and the popping neon as you just described it. Is that highlighted in the film? Do we see a lot of that?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there are moments where simply the camera just pans onto the Musso and Frank sign or the Vista Theater or El Coyote and the neon pops. I mean, clearly the directors, the art directors, the whole team just relishes those visual moments. I mean, one of the just early scenes in the movie is you witness Rick Dalton, played by Leo DiCaprio, his sidekick Cliff Booth, played by Brad Pitt, who's also his driver, and they're reversing out of a parking spot. You think they're underneath a billboard. They're in fact underneath what turns out to be a great big poster. It's actually parked in Dalton's driveway right beside his house. The movie poster advertises one of the westerns that Dalton has starred in called Comanche Rising. And this, according to Tina Sherrard, she's a graphic designer who worked on the film, this is sort of emblematic of the director Quentin Tarantino's love of posters of that period.
Quentin has an encyclopedic knowledge of film of all eras, but specifically on the period we were working on. And every poster that went into that movie, whether it was set dressing or the billboards that were on the streets or in Leo's house, they were chosen and really kind of worked on with Quentin. He knew, you know, what he wanted where, whether they were commissioned or whether they were pieces from his own archive. He was very precise about what was going where.
Well, if Quentin Tarantino has this encyclopedic knowledge, right, of posters, and that's his thing, right, that he really wants to accentuate those things, I suspect there are things that maybe he can't show in the movie, right?
Yeah, yes, absolutely. I mean, that happens with all period movies, but it's particularly interesting, especially anyone who grew up here and really remembers LA. So, for example, there's a scene in Westwood Village when Sharon Tate, who's played by Margot Robbie, she goes to the Bruin, which is there still
there.
She goes to actually watch herself in a movie. It's kind of a fascinating scene, actually. But anyway, right now at that intersection is a four-way crosswalk of the kind that you would not have had then. And Tina Sherrard said, yes, that part of the design team's job was getting rid of period incorrect graphics.
You don't have as much information on street signs now, parking signs and things like that. Or now we have a lot of, on Hollywood Boulevard, I remember all the kind of squares, like heritage square signs and things, which then they didn't have. So we had to come up with inventive ways to cover them because we couldn't remove some of them. And I make those sort of things disappear.
Disappear. What, CGI,
I know. It's
right?
It's a fascinating part of the job because on the one hand they're creating, but they're also disappearing visuals as well.
Yeah, it sounds to me a lot like that the visuals dominate this movie, really.
Yes, the visuals dominate. And what Tina has found, Tina, who happens to be a Brit like myself, so hasn't spent her entire life here, but she and all the other folks that have worked on the design team have found that people who grew up here just love the trip down memory lane. However, we should say there is one significant detail from that period that they do leave out, and that was smog.
Yeah, when you think about the late 60s and early 70s, I mean, a lot of people, and I didn't grow up in L.A., but I've been here for long enough to know that people talked about the smog alert days. You couldn't see the skyline. You couldn't see the mountains. I mean, people joke about the fact, L.A. has mountains? Yeah, because you couldn't see them because the smog was so thick. Why would they leave that out?
Well, because this movie is, as Tina told me as well, this is Quentin Tarantino's sort of alternate universe. This movie takes you down memory lane to a selective version of L.A.
with the
circa
empty freeways.
1969.
Frances Anderton, who hosts Design and Architecture Tuesdays at 1:30 right here on KCRW. Frances, thanks.
You're very welcome.
Better air quality today, by the way. Maybe a little humid, though. A little touch of humidity today. With high temperatures in the 70s and 80s, too. I did a full weather forecast. That's it for the program today. Tomorrow, cashless restaurants are becoming a thing. While your favorite eatery only takes plastic or your smartphone. Coming up next on KCRW, all the president's lawyers, Catherine Barnes, Jenna Cagle, Sonia Geis, Phil Richards, Ray Guarna, PJ Shahamat, and Christian Bordahl. Well, they make this show happen every day. We're online at kcrw.com/greaterLA, wherever you get your podcasts. You can reach out to us on Facebook or Twitter by hashtagging it Greater LA. I'm so glad you joined us. Proud that you're here with us each and every day. Thanks for your ear and for the time. Have a great day.